Hello there. My name is Dan Kilbride. I'm the host of New Books in American Studies, and I'm also the professor of history and chair of the history department at John Carroll University outside of Cleveland, Ohio. And I'm very excited, that's not an exaggeration, to be joined today by Ed Baptist. He is a professor of history at Cornell University, teaches history at Cornell University. He's the author previously of a terrific book called Creating an Old South, which is about the plantation frontier in antebellum Florida, which is published by the University of North Carolina Press. And he's here today to discuss his brand spanking new book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism, which has been published by Basic Books. Ed Baptist, welcome to New Books in American Studies.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
So this is a book about slavery in the United States, and I'm going to just give the very briefest of introductions here to say that I don't think it's any exaggeration, and I am biased, I admit, but I'm right about this, that the literature on American slavery has been the most exciting and dynamic theme in American historical writing, at least for the past 30, maybe 40 years. And it's amazing how sustained that excitement and dynamism has become. You might think that a subject that has been the focus of so much study for such a long time might become musty and old, yet historians still manage to find new and exciting things about it. It is really a wonderful literature. And I think this book, even more remarkably, manages to say a lot of new and exciting things about this. So, Ed, tell us about yourself and the path that brought you to this book.
There are, of course, so many ways to answer that question and so many paths, but I think just to hit the first one first, the question about myself is that I grew up in Durham, North Carolina, in an era, the 1970s and 1980s, when at least in fits and starts, the U.S. Education system was trying the process of integration. And so although I'm white, I ended up in a lot of schools that were majority black, with a lot of teachers that were African American. And what I began to notice back at a fairly early age was that there was a considerable difference in the ways that the sort of white media and the larger established point of view of the United States told the history of slavery, as opposed to what I would hear from my African American teachers, or what I might hear once we got into some of the stories that they told in class about people like Frederick Douglass or Harriet Tubman. You know, even though there was an ongoing attempt to incorporate those stories in academia at that time, although I didn't necessarily know when I was in, let's say, third grade, there was still, even as I got a little older, went to college and grad school and so on, and I dug into a lot of the white authored histories, even the histories of slavery, there were still differences between that more popular, I think deeper rooted story of slavery that I had been hearing even as a child, and the larger academic story that was being told.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned in my introduction that, you know, the literature on slavery is getting, you know, it's getting a little old. There was a point, of course, in American historical literature when slavery – the story wasn't told at all. You mentioned in your introduction about, you know, American history textbooks. Even today, slavery gets maybe 25 pages. It's covered, you know, tends to be like the 1850s. It's like the snapshot of slavery, and that's pretty much all you need to know. And it struck me that this book reminds me a little bit of a much older book – in its emphasis on the violence of slavery and the suffering of enslaved people, and that is Kenneth Stamp's mm-hmm. Peculiar Institution. And I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about how literature on slavery has evolved over the past 20 or 30 years, and what the biggest influences on you, in historical literature as you approach this book.
Yeah, I think that's a interesting comparison, because as I prepared to write this book, and I should say the first book you mentioned was a a community study of a frontier area of the South, and writing that book is what was sort of the direct cause the direct impetus that pushed me into deciding that what I needed to do next was write a history of the expansion of slavery across multiple frontiers and multiple decades, multiple states of the South. But as I reviewed the literature in preparation for this new book, what I did realize is that there were a couple of older books that seemed to have been a little bit forgotten as various currents of conflict and debate and so on in American society pushed them to the side, but which did seem to have a lot to say that had perhaps been forgotten, and Stamp was certainly one of them. Stamp did write about violence a lot more than some of the other historians who followed them, or a lot more directly and explicitly. And he did write, actually, surprisingly more about things like the domestic slave trade, mm-hmm. which occupied a much smaller share of attention in the writing of the 1960s and 70s and 80s about slavery. That writing was less concerned with arguing and establishing that slavery was a violent process of exploitation, and much more concerned with arguing that enslaved African Americans had created a culture that could, in terms of the psychological cushioning and sustenance it could provide to African Americans, that it was able to withstand the impact of the kind of violence and exploitation that I suppose as historians took as a given. Mm-hmm. In the wake of those so-called community studies, historians began to spend a little bit more time talking about things like divisions in the slave community, or change over time in some cases, or increasingly the slave trade. And you see that in books by Michael Tadman and Walter Johnson that began to appear in the 1990s and early 2000s. So that's sort of what historiographically led up to this book. But I think in a different sense, for me personally, the first book I wrote was about the South, and it was about the interplay between white and black and rich and poor, frontier and older states. And it probably had a lot to do with my family of origin in that sense, and trying to figure out how their history fit mm-hmm. into the larger history of the South. But this book is much more about how the history of the South fits into, I think, the history of the broader United States, the right. world, in fact.
And you know, one of the things that might surprise anybody at all who's been paying even a little bit of attention to histories of the Old South and slavery is the subtitle, and that is Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. You know, to make a very long story short, most people do not associate slavery with capitalism, and many people see them as opposites. How, you know, we'll elaborate on this later, but how do you see slavery as a capitalist enterprise? And, you know, briefly, how do you think it contributed to the growth of the United States in the 19th century and beyond?
Yeah, I mean, that's
a big one. I know.
That's a big one. I wrote a book about that, in fact. But let me try to put a couple of key points into an answer. I think that we could talk in a little bit about why historians stopped talking about capitalism, which they did for a long time, and they're starting to talk about it much more mm-hmm. explicitly now. But even now, a lot of what historians are saying about capitalism is still pretty limited. It doesn't put together the production, distribution, and consumption and financialization sides of capitalism. And all of those are part of the equation of the social and intellectual and conceptual system that has transformed the world since the 1700s. I mean, we live very, very differently, not just from people a generation ago because of ongoing, tremendous, innovative economic and technological change that we call capitalism, but wildly differently from the way people lived in 1750 and even the most developed mm-hmm. societies in the world. And In fact, people in 1750, on the other hand, typically lived in a state much more similar to those in 5000 BC than we are to the way people lived in 1750. So this is a massive, massive change in human history. And one of the things I argue in the book is that American slavery, especially as it develops after the Revolution, is tremendously significant to that change. And we haven't typically seen American slavery as a major part of that change. And sometimes we've seen its growth and development in the Cotton South as antithetical to that change, as sort of a parking brake that was keeping the U.S. from fully committing to capitalist development. And that's partly because there was a big political conflict over slavery, and Northern opponents of slavery decided that they were the true capitalists and the true modern people, and that slavery was a sort of backward thing. But if you actually look at the way slavery worked, and then you also look at its, let's say, contribution to broader capitalism, mm-hmm. you see that it is deeply, deeply capitalist in a lot of important ways. So one of the things I discovered in the first book, it's sort of a small part of the first book, and I couldn't actually get people to pay much attention to this at the time, but later, for reasons I'll explain, they got much more interested. One of the things I realized was that, first of all, expanding slavery, which was a process that continued from the 90s right up until 1860, and the desire to expand slavery was actually the proximate cause of the Civil War. Expanding slavery was expensive for the planters, or as I often call them, entrepreneurs who wanted to do it. A young enslaved man cost generally around $1,000, which in terms of the amount of wage labor that could buy you was something along the order of $250,000 in 2014 dollars. So this is a very expensive investment, about the same as a house in many parts of the U.S. today. Mm-hmm. So how did slave owners do this? Well, they already had property, and so they had collateral, but they needed a cash flow in order to actually, and often a cash flow that was bigger than what they were getting from their crops, in order to make that big capital investment. And it turns out that what they did was they went to big urban centers like London and Amsterdam and Hamburg and New York, Boston, to get that money. And in fact, in the 1830s, what they got really good at was creating innovative new financial products that are really very similar to some of the things that were done, that have been done on Wall Street since the 1980s. Everything old comes new again. They created a process in which they essentially securitized enslaved people and sold bonds on those worldwide financial markets to raise money, which then they pumped back into their own accounts to buy more slaves. In return, the people who bought the bonds got essentially a slice of the income from individual slaves. Now, people weren't interested. Historians were not interested in hearing about this in the 1990s and early 2000s. But after very similar operation, except done with houses instead of slaves, imploded and dragged down the whole world economy with it in 2008, suddenly people were much more interested in this. So it turns out that slavery was financially deeply embedded in all of the circuits of credit that flowed around the Western world in the early 1800s. And they were embedded in ways that are recognizably identical in many of its key points to the way that credit works in today's capitalist economy. Mm-hmm. It didn't flow as quickly. Information didn't flow as quickly, but the processes were very similar. Enslavers were constantly borrowing in order to expand their operations. And on the other hand, on the production side, we might think that what was going on in the cotton fields was very different from what we see as the essential capitalist production function of wage labor. That's what Karl Marx said was the be-all and end-all of capitalist production. And people have tended to follow that as a kind of dogma. But what's significant about wage labor for not just for Marx, but for Adam Smith and people from all over the political spectrum who look at capitalism, what's significant about wage labor systems is that they build in incentives for innovation, which continually produces more product with the same amount of labor, thus expanding the amount of goods that are available. And this breaks us out of the old bottlenecks of old agricultural societies, which changed very, very slowly and usually could not accumulate too much to protect societies from starvation, much less from falling into a sort of stasis where they weren't expanding, weren't changing technologically. So what's interesting is that what actually happens as enslavers expand their cotton operations and as they move large numbers of slaves into places like Mississippi and Alabama is that they have incentives to produce more cotton all the time. The world market for cotton is growing because of the Industrial Revolution that's taking place in Britain. And all they have to do is to figure out how to make more cotton. They have two problems. The first is one of processing. It's hard to get the seeds out of cotton fibers. Mm-hmm. We know all about the cotton gin. We know that that's what happened. They have a mechanical solution. But picking is the other bottleneck. And in 1800, most people could pick at most about 40, 45 pounds a day. Picking is really hard, and no mechanical solution was invented until the 1930s. What slave owners figure out to do is to create incentives for cotton picking, and this isn't by paying more. This is by measuring more and whipping more. So they set individual incentives, and you can see this very, very clearly in the film 12 Years a Slave, actually.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In fact, Steve McQueen and the 12 Years a Slave crew do a better job of depicting that than virtually any historian.
Hmm.
So everybody has an individual quota. If they don't make the quota, if their bag is weighed at the end of the day and they haven't made the quota, they're whipped. And sometimes it's very explicitly a kind of capitalist accounting. Okay, you're 5 pounds short. An enslaver told Israel Campbell when he was learning how to pick cotton in Mississippi in the late 1820s. You're 5 pounds short. And so you owe me a debt, and I'm going to exact repayment in the form of 5 lashes, 1 pound short, one more lash. And these were pretty brutal whips that were being used. So people learn how to pick to their quota. And what enslavers then do is raise the quota. And over time, primarily, I would argue, because of this process of measuring and then raising of the quota, what happens is that enslaved people pick faster, so that by 1860, the average enslaved person is picking about three or four times faster than the average enslaved person in 1800. And this is tremendous. They're producing this absolutely crucial product for the Industrial Revolution 4 times as fast as they did in 1800. And although the price of slaves goes up, it doesn't go up that fast in real dollars.
You referenced Steve McQueen's movie, and anybody who's read Solomon Northup's account, you know, when he arrives on a cotton plantation, he is absolutely stunned with the speed with which the slaves pick cotton. He simply can't believe it.
Yeah, and he can't keep up.
No, he can't.
And it's very hard for him to adapt. And in fact, he never really does. And this is part of why the people that enslavers on the cotton frontier wanted to buy were young men and women, ranged from preteens up to at most in the early 20s. That's when prices were highest. And a big part of it was because they were still malleable enough to learn how to pick at the kind of speeds that were demanded. It's hard to learn after that kind of age.
Yeah. I do want to get into the nitty gritty of the book, and one of the interesting things that I think that readers will find about this book is that it really focuses on a period of slavery that especially textbooks don't really focus on, and that is that I mentioned in the introduction that if you read an American history textbook, you tend to get this sort of snapshot of slavery that focuses on the 1850s, the very last decade of slavery. But you spend a lot of time on the late 18th and early 19th centuries, especially to discuss the interstate slave trade. One of the things you argue in the early part of the book is that you observe that in the very early years of its history, the United States was actually in a fairly precarious geopolitical situation. It wasn't very united. There wasn't a lot of things that tied Americans together, and you argue that slavery's expansion actually helped forge the United States together. How did it do that?
Well, first of all, agreeing to let slavery expand is the price of union at the Constitutional Convention. South Carolina and Georgia, and maybe North Carolina, at least said they were willing to walk if slavery was not going to be allowed to expand. Mm-hmm. And right there, in 1787, the major focus is the international slave trade. They want that to continue. But I also think that allowing it to expand into other territories is a part of the subtext there. There are debates already in the Continental Congress about that. And South Carolina, Georgia, North Carolina, again, have successfully blocked, for instance, provisions that might have kept slavery from expanding into what is today Tennessee and Mississippi and Alabama. And so it's literally the political price of union in that sense. But slavery's expansion and its ability to start bringing in revenue for the American economy, and this is a cash-poor economy, an economy that needs the ability to trade overseas, to buy things from overseas, to bring in investments from overseas, but doesn't have much to sell. Slavery's expansion gives that economy something to sell. It gives it products that are coming onto the international market at exactly the right time, in particular cotton in the 1790s and then the first decades of the 19th century. So it fuels all kinds of other development. And of course, it fuels the further development of slavery. And then finally, slavery helps to create these internal financial networks that bind the interests of wealthy people in the Northeast to the interests of wealthy people in the Southeast and increasingly the Southwest, and helps to produce a class that has a lot invested in the future unity of the United States. And that, in a sense, is exactly what James Madison and Alexander Hamilton were arguing the U.S. needed in the Federalist Papers, and then for Hamilton in his establishment of a kind of a formal national financial system, mm-hmm. a formal set of networks focused around the first Bank of the United States. But this other set of financial networks, which certainly, you know, uses the First National Bank, and certainly we need the Second Bank of the United States as well, they also have the same effect of producing a national elite that is dependent on keeping the issue of slavery suppressed as an issue of conflict, and on allowing slavery to expand further westward.
You also observe that you know, the Haitian Revolution, which is, I think, beginning to get a lot more attention in, you know, sort of conventional U.S. history textbooks and classes. You know, on the one hand, the Haitian Revolution kind of sounds the death knell to, you know, one kind of slavery, but it also helps as sort of the midwife to a new kind of slavery in the United States. How did the Haitian Revolution contribute to this sort of a new frontier for slavery in the southwestern United States?
Well, you know, first of all, in a very mechanical sense, I mean, in a very clear way, what it does is it forces Napoleon to sell the Louisiana Territory to the United States. And this allows the U.S. to expand in ways that simply wouldn't have been possible if it didn't control the Mississippi River and its outlet. Napoleon had dreams of a American empire. That's quite clear. He invested tens of thousands of troops in reconquering Saint-Domingue from the rebels who had come to control it by the 1790s. And it's clear that he wanted to reinstitute slavery there, but he fails in doing so because of the resistance of the Haitian people. And so he's forced to abandon his plans and do something that he had been previously unwilling to do, which is sell New Orleans and Louisiana Territory. So that's absolutely necessary for the mention of this continental kind of slavery. But the Haitian Revolution also convinces European powers and perhaps the U.S. as well to abandon international slave trade to make it illegal and make its banning be a kind of a sign of civilized nationhood. So U.S. bans it and Britain bans it, and then Britain begins to put a lot of pressure on other nations, Spain and Portugal and so on, to ban it. And it takes a long time to do it, and even then it continues. But what this does is it ensures, and this is not the purpose of banning the slave trade, but it ensures that it's going to be very hard for any other nation or any colony to compete with U.S. as a producer of cotton, because slave-produced cotton was more efficient in the early 1800s than cotton produced by free people. And unlike the British Islands or the Spanish colonies, U.S. slavery by 1800 had become very successful at reproducing itself, at growing because of internal natural growth. Without the slave trade, British colonies were not going to be able to compete with American production of cotton.
You focus in the early years of the 19th century, and the way you talk about the expansion of the cotton frontier, and as you describe, instead of using the word planters, you tend to use the word entrepreneurs. It's almost like a frenzy of expansion and growth. And at one point in the book where you talk about, you know, the way we usually think about capitalism as this, it's very rational system. You know, people make choices based on their self-interest. But you argue in some ways that this is a lot of – it's almost like gambling, that these entrepreneurs, as they're envisioning this cotton empire, they're not necessarily making rational choices. They have these visions that they are sort of gambling on. And how did entrepreneurs, you know, after about 1815, how did they successfully organize this massive expansion of cotton cultivation?
Yeah, I don't think any of us who lived through the 1980s and the 1990s and the 2000s can really, with a straight face, claim that capitalism, especially in a sort of a boom era, is really fully rational. I mean, clearly people are acting in their own self-interest as they perceive it, and at the same time they're also being driven by a lot of emotional needs and emotional desires. And in the case of people who have power in a given situation, who have a sense that they're going to be able to bend, economic exchanges to their own benefit, that they're going to be able to bend the labor of other people to their own benefit. I think in those cases they're able to make their more emotionally driven visions, their desires, if you will, they're going to make those things into reality, at least for a little while. And of course, whether that's in one's own best interest over the long run, that's a different question. But sometimes it does work out for those guys. In the specific case of the U.S. South after 1815, I mean, slave owners have by that point started to figure out a system that will allow them to extract more cotton every year from the same number of enslaved people. They're able to turn enslaved people into collateral for loans with increasingly more exotic forms of credit. They're able to do that because the cotton that those enslaved people is so important to the world economy and is such an important source of all kinds of profit, including the profit of those who lend and those who speculate on the securities that enslavers create. And then finally, the rules of engagement in U.S. politics are set up in such a way that slave owners have outsized influence. They have outsized influence in their own communities, but they also have influence on the national stage. I mean, I have to sit down, and I'm always forgetting the exact figure of how many U.S. presidents before Lincoln who I think was the 13th. But how many of them were slave owners? But the majority of them were slave owners. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that even when they weren't slave owners, they needed slave owners in order to be elected. And so they followed policies that were deeply complicit in the expansion of slavery.
Yeah. And just as an aside here, one of the books that I thought was really made that point effectively in sort of a micro way was a book by a guy named Bill Duesenberry, who wrote a book on James K. Polk mm-hmm. as a slave owner. And it's a very eye-opening account of this relentless entrepreneur. And it was something you said earlier reminded me when you mentioned young slaves being sort of more malleable and more teachable. That's precisely the sort of slaves that James Polk bought under the table so that Americans wouldn't find out about it. He had a reputation as a slave owner, and there was something else going on quite differently than that. You know, I think that readers will be struck by the way you portray these slaveholding entrepreneurs, the way they construct this cotton empire, and the way you've talked about this already, but the way they develop this extremely efficient system for extracting labor from slaves. And you didn't say this word before, but in the book you use the word torture to describe the system of labor extraction. And I think it might strike readers who have a passing familiarity with or even just an image of the Old South that is so opposite of the portrayal that you deliver in this book. So how have we missed this? I know not everybody has. Certainly, you open the book with the story of this WPA interviewer who is talking to the slave who sort of, tells him, this was a terrible thing, and it describes some of the things you talk about in the book. But how has our sort of dominant image of the Old South, how have we missed this, what you've talked about in this book?
Well, I think if we heard about in another country, let's say the Taliban taking over part of Afghanistan again, as they're doing, and let's say we heard about them grabbing people who didn't follow their rules and carting them off somewhere and ripping the clothes off of them and beating their backs brutally until they bled, but also consented to do what their oppressors said. I don't think we would have a problem calling it torture. And there were, of course, lots of other things that enslavers did that went even beyond whipping. So I don't think we would call it a torture. I think we would call it torture. And I think that in the U.S. context, we've agreed to not name it for what it was. And we agreed that as a society a very long time ago. I mean, we agreed it well before the Civil War because of the needs of national unity. It was simply not politic to say that what was happening in order to generate 50% of American exports was torture. We simply couldn't say that. Now, there were some people who did say that, such as enslaved people, and then when they were occasionally able to escape, they named it for what it was. And there were a few whites who listened to that, and they were abolitionists, and they were seen as radicals by and large and excluded from proper society. Right up until the very edge of the Civil War. And then after the Civil War, in order to make national reunion go more smoothly, of course, African Americans in the wake of Reconstruction were gradually and yet violently excluded from the ability to actually exercise the rights of citizenship. And historians, white historians, as they're writing what are really the first professional histories of the United States, incorporate these plantation myths, which are being propagated in the wake of the Civil War by apologists for the South. And so once again, the idea that all of this wealth that was generated by slavery was generated by violence, was pushed off the stage. And that has persisted, I think, a lot longer in our ideas about slavery than we'd like to admit, at least in mainstream American culture. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some really complicated reasons for that. And some of them, I think, have to do with nation. Some of them have to do with race and the way that African-American pain is perceived. We're starting to get some very interesting, literally laboratory studies about how people react when they see black skin being pierced by a needle as opposed to white skin being pierced by a needle. I think that's probably part of it. But also part of it, and I hope that my book can go in some small way towards rectifying. I think part of it is just that the story hasn't been told in the right way. It's been told in ways that are still muzzled by these needs to see slavery as something that's ultimately nonviolent, that's ultimately paternalistic, that's ultimately not this tremendously violent institution at the heart of American history.
One of the things you discuss at length in your book is how enslaved people coped with this system, with this torture. How did they manage? You put a big emphasis on survival. And you don't sort of poo-poo survival. You see, survival was, under the circumstances, almost a heroic feat. You know, we shouldn't necessarily – you emphasize, you know, a lot of attention to slavery and slaves is about resistance and escapes and those sort of very exceptional things. But you emphasize something a little more mundane, and that is survival, just, you know, how people coped with suffering. How did enslaved people – Just cope with it.
Yeah, I think for the people who I've put at the center of the book, which is forced migrants, enslaved African Americans who are moved by force from the communities where they grew up in the older slave states like Maryland and Virginia to the newer slave states. I think for those people, it was a particularly fraught question because they were being put through some violent and often extremely deadly processes, being put into a new disease environment that was much worse, being forced to learn new kinds of labor and to learn them in this extremely exacting way with the threat of violence hanging over their head, and to do this all while being ripped out away from everything they'd known and cast among strangers. Yeah, in those circumstances, absolutely, survival is not a given. Survival is itself a kind of resistance, and is necessary for everything else that happens. And in a lot of slave societies, over time, and for a lot of the individuals who were taken to these new cotton states, survival didn't happen. Most slave societies have to be continually fed by new imports because the population is continually decreasing. People do not survive. And yet, slaves in the American Southwest, the majority of them did survive. The cost of that was often very high in all kinds of ways. One way that they survived was that they created ways of helping each other survive. They created a new dialect so they could talk to each other. What linguists talk about now is the sort of most common African-American dialect was by the early 20th century, the prevailing dialect from more or less New Orleans up to Kentucky, all across the cotton country and the country in general that had been settled in this great forced migration. It's a creation of that great forced migration. And people then took it from those states and spread it all across the U.S. in the great migration. They created all sorts of other cultural patterns and elements that helped them survive, patterns of family. And maybe most importantly, they created a language, not just a dialect, but a way of thinking about what was happening to them, which protected them in certain ways, gave them reasons to survive, gave them a focus and a hope that eventually slavery would be recognized for what it was, And they'd have a chance to bring it down. And that, in fact, is what happens in the Civil War. But even as American society in general is sweeping the expansion of slavery under the rug as quickly as it can and trying to avoid all conflict over this issue, enslaved people are naming it for what it is. They're naming it as the greatest crime that they see in the world around them. They're naming everything that happens to them as fundamentally wrong. And those who do escape from slavery take that very powerful, very searing, very succinct critique out there. And it becomes the ideological basis, the backbone of just about everything that abolitionists, black or white, say against slavery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think you talk a lot about this concept of theft, that, you know, black people saw this as stealing. On a massive scale. You talk a lot about the interstate slave trade, and certainly you're not the first person who's done this. You've referenced earlier in the interview Walter Johnson, who of course has done this. But you really talk about the way that the slave trade becomes institutionalized, and it becomes this very well-developed cog of capitalism. How did entrepreneurs construct this massive infrastructure for transferring so many people over such large distances?
Well, they do it bit by bit, in one sense. So what one decade's slave traders create becomes a foundation for another set of innovations in the next generation. So the early domestic slave trade to South Carolina and Georgia is in some ways sort of rudimentary. People are doing it. Slave traders are doing it with local financing that they cobble together from their home communities in South Carolina and Georgia. They'll go up to Virginia and buy two or three slaves here, buy two or three slaves there. But later it develops into something much bigger and much more organized. And in part, that's because generation after generation, slave traders are able to get the financing that they need from the developing financial institutions of the United States, from the national banks, but also from the other banks that work with the national banks. Mm-hmm. And this means that they're tapping into credit flows that stretch all the way across the Atlantic, certainly all the way across the United States. So that combination of new ideas and techniques with new flows of financing, everybody in Silicon Valley knows that that's how you get a startup going. And that's exactly, you know, what the slave traders of every decade did. They came in, they learned a little bit about the system, often working for another slave trader, and they had an idea for a new way of doing things. So they change dramatically over time, and we should recognize them as both horrifically evil people, I would argue, but also as people who are part and parcel of the wider capitalist world in which they live. They're not really exceptions. Mm-hmm. They illustrate the possibilities that existed.
Tell us a little bit about how slaves were valued. When I mean that in a very specific way. I mean, how slave traders and their customers attached monetary values to different kinds of slaves.
So we know that we have enough price data on the New Orleans market over time to recognize certain statistical patterns. And what I would say is that, as I mentioned before, age is really important mm-hmm. in terms of valuing slaves. And for men, that's because of their labor potential. And with women, it's because of their labor potential, but also maybe their reproductive potential, the ability of a slave owner to imagine that they would be able to bear children who would then be the slave owner's property. But we can find a really clear statistical relationship, not just between age and price, but for men between height and price. Hmm. And I think height was seen as a proxy of overall health. And so you might get a 16-year-old, you might buy a 16-year-old young man and imagine that this person would learn to pick cotton more quickly than, let's say, a 24-year-old. But if that person died of malaria 2 or 3 months later, that wouldn't do the slave owner much good. So they needed some way to think about height, to understand height or to understand health. And height was often a pretty good proxy for that. And you know, we know that within a given sort of genetic potential height, that it often is a good proxy for someone's health history. With women, it was a little different. It's pretty clear that from the letters of slave traders that sexual attractiveness was a big part of the price as well. And it was a big part of the price because slave traders could use that to sell the woman to male enslavers. But it was also part of the price because slave traders and slave owners alike were constantly engaged in sexual assault on women to such an extent that I would argue they really couldn't think about buying and selling slaves without that being a part of the equation. Mm-hmm. There's actually some pretty good behavioral economic work that's been done. Again, this is sort of laboratory work, and maybe it only applies to people in the 2010s, but I suspect it has some relevance to the 1830s or 1850s. And that data, those experiments seem to show that when you've got male test subjects and you're talking to them about economic questions, you know, should you buy this or buy that? Should you make this investment, which is more risky, or that which is less risky? And then you insert images of women who they consider sexually attractive. What the men do economically, their behavior in terms of buying and selling, investing and risking and so on, changes fairly dramatically. And they are much more interested in risky economic behaviors at that point. They're primed for that kind of behavior. And so cultivating a sort of sexualization of the slave trade was good for the business of slave traders. The promise of rape literally made more sales for them.
Well, that's really interesting. You describe the decade, not exactly a decade, but the period from roughly 1829 to 1837 as a particularly horrific one for enslaved people, in a way that, you know, entrepreneurs, you've already described the ways in which these entrepreneurs made slavery a very productive and efficient system. But you argue that, you know, the decade before 1837 or so was sort of, you know, either the nadir or the, you know, apex of this system, where they got even more creative in developing tools to, you know, bleed profit out of slaves. What's so remarkable about that 8 or 9 year period?
Yeah, I think all of the conditions come together in exactly the right way for to create an environment where entrepreneurs, and the economist Joseph Schumpeter says, what's an entrepreneur? It's somebody who engages in creation and destruction in terms of their economic behavior. They're able to come up with new ways to approach or engage in market behavior that radically reshape those markets, often destroying older patterns of business. And conditions are perfect for that from the perspective of Southern enslavers in that decade. If you look at the international environment, the cotton market for most of that time is pretty solid. It's pretty strong. There's a lot of demand. There's a rapid expansion of the market for textiles, which are made primarily at that point in northern Britain, and primarily it's expanding in cotton textiles. So there's a lot of demand for their product. There is a lot of credit floating around on the international market, a lot of savings, let's say, that is looking for an investment home. And so enslavers just have to find a way to channel it to them. And more locally, that's also a decade that's dominated by Andrew Jackson, who himself was a Southwestern planter entrepreneur par excellence. He had not only conquered all this territory in the War of 812 for Southern enslavers, as president, he finished handing it over to them by expelling Native Americans west or east of the Mississippi across the river to the Indian Territory, today's mm-hmm. Oklahoma. And so this opens up huge, huge new territories for expansion. So all of the possibilities for creating a massive wave of excitement and actualization of new businesses, new plantations or slave labor camps, if you will, it's all there. You've got the credit. You've got the political environment lined up in the right way. You've got the market for the products. The only thing that stands in the way to some extent is perhaps the Second National Bank, which is run by a guy named Nicholas Biddle at that time. Nicholas Biddle is in many ways very, very smart central banker. He's been very successful in the 1820s at steadily feeding national macroeconomic growth without letting the economy overheat. And primarily he does this by regulating local banks. He makes sure that they have enough money to lend, but he also makes sure that their practices are not too disruptive to that they are smart, sober sorts of practices. And Andrew Jackson goes after Nicholas Biddle after he's elected in 1829. And over the course of the next 4 or 5 years, removes his ability to control the American financial economy. In other words, it's the same as if a president would be elected in our day, and they would gradually strip the Federal Reserve of its mm-hmm. power to control the American economy. And they would simply say to American banks, lend as much as you want. Now, some people might say that's kind of what the Federal Reserve has done at certain points in time, and others might argue with that. But certainly when you have uncontrolled lending practices, which is what you get, especially after 1833, then it's possible for a modern financialized economy to overheat very quickly. And that's what happens. Slave owners buy and sell they move about 250,000 enslaved people to the new states between 1830 and 1837, and they double the production of cotton. And on a micro level, what this means is 250,000 people have to go through what Solomon Northup went through. Mm-hmm. They have to go through this process of being ripped from everyone they know. Even if they're not free people who get kidnapped, they are ripped from their families and moved south and west. And then they have to learn how to work in a totally different way, under the constant threat of torture and the constant pressure to increase the speed of what they're making. But eventually enough of them survive and enough of them are able to increase the amount of cotton that they make that between 1830 and 1837, the amount of cotton that the U.S. produces doubles. And this turns out to be too much for the world market to absorb. Mm-hmm. And all of these planters who have borrowed massive amounts of money to radically expand their operations are in serious financial trouble at that time, as is the global financial economy, which goes into a panic in 1837 and again in 1839.
Right. You know, given that this book really talks about slavery as a fundamental drive to the growth of American capitalism, not just the Southern economy, and you make it clear that the North benefited very tangibly from slavery's expansion. Yet many Northerners came to oppose the expansion of slavery. How do you explain that?
I think, as I said before, you've got white abolitionists who are a very small minority in the North who oppose slavery because of their own reasons. But one of those reasons is that they're persuaded by what formerly enslaved African Americans tell them. They're persuaded that slavery is horrifically evil and that it threatens to undermine all of the values that they claim to hold dear. And so they're faced with this moment where they have to mark their convictions to the reality of what's going on. And many of them, I think, to their immense credit, are able to stand up and say, this thing that everybody's conniving at, it's bad and it needs to be changed, even though that change will create some pretty fundamental disruptions. So I think that's one thing that happens. But as I said, they're generally speaking a small minority in most northern communities. Oberlin, Ohio might be the one place where they're a majority. So that's just one place. But 1837 and 1839 are I think really fundamental turning points in U.S. history because that's the point in time where many Northerners begin to realize that Southern planter entrepreneurs have a very serious amount of control over their own economic fortunes, and they don't really seem to care about how that affects Northerners. So if Southerners want to borrow as much money as they possibly can, if they want to sort of create a economy run wild with speculation because it seems that will benefit them, they don't seem to consider the disruption that might entail for Northerners. They simply went ahead and destroyed the Second National Bank. They simply went ahead and forced the Indians out, et cetera, et cetera. So they began to revive at that point much more seriously a sort of old Northern anxiety, which is an anxiety about the political power of Southern planters. And so the argument that the national government is controlled by what some call a, for instance, John Palfrey, this Harvard professor, magazine editor, et cetera, this guy, kind of quintessential Northerner who's actually related to Southern planters, he starts to refer to what he calls a slave power. Capital S, capital P, a slave power that is right, directing the politics of the U.S., directing the political economy in a way that is fundamentally opposed to the benefit of and the further development of the North. Now, I think we could say functionally, 1840s is also the point where we really start to see the Northern economy growing of its own momentum, not being completely connected to the ups and downs of the cotton market, starting to develop industries that are not directly tied to the cotton economy. Before the 1840s, virtually all Northern industry of note had some kind of pretty direct connection to the cotton economy, like weaving cotton into cloth, which was then sold back to Southern plantations, things like that. After 1840, other things start to spring up, and they're much more oriented towards a Northern market. So the Northern economy has achieved what 1950s economists would call a takeoff point, where it can grow on its own. And so I think that fact permits Northerners at a very deep level to start to think about reining in the growth of the Southern plantation complex.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I do want to wrap this up by kind of bringing us back to something you talk about in your introduction. And that is that the history that you're talking about, the history of slavery, is not just something that's of antiquarian interest, that the history of slavery matters. And the way that we remember that history, the memory of how we talk about slavery matters today. What do you think is the significance today of this history that you're telling?
Well, I would point to three questions, let's put it that way, that have been in the news over the last 6 months. And all of these show the way in which we are all directly affected by A, the history of slavery's effects, and B, the effects of how we understand it. And the first one, most obviously, I would point to Ferguson and the debates that have followed the shooting of Michael Brown, because the way in which African Americans are policed today, I think many people would argue, and I think with certainly with some salience, is directly shaped by slavery and by anxieties about the possibility of slave revolt the possibilities of enslaved people's violence in reaction to the violence that was being done to them. And I think the way that African Americans have been policed has always been different, and it continues to be different. And we're still coming to grips with that as a society. The second thing I would point to is that's the question of sort of legal process, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a question about access, whether or not African Americans have access to the full fruits of American possibilities. And this is a question that at least in some circles was being discussed very heavily last summer, especially following the publication of a long article by Ta-Nehisi Coates in The Atlantic, which once again brought up the question of reparations for slavery and the way that both ongoing processes and sort of legacy wealth or the lack of legacy wealth continue to constrain the opportunity of African Americans for full progress. And a side of that that's really important is the ways in which that limited access for African Americans helps some Americans, some white Americans, but it also hurts a lot of other white Americans. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing I would say is related to or was brought into the news by the publication of Thomas Piketty's book on wealth and inequality. And that brings up even bigger questions of the legacy of slavery and the way that wealth is distributed in this country and the ways in which the wealth of slavery may still be present and visible among us as accumulations of value and power in the hands of some people and not in the hands of other people. And that, again, is something which doesn't just affect African Americans. It affects all people in the United States. So those are just three. I wouldn't call them small ways because they're all about huge questions. But those are three, I think, pretty clear ways in which we are still dealing. We're still dealing with slavery, or perhaps in some ways not dealing with slavery.
Right.
Perhaps should be dealing with slavery and thinking about the history of slavery as we understand current problems of distribution, of access, and of process.
Well, Ed, we've taken up over an hour of your life. So I know you just published this terrific book. So please forgive the next question, which is the last one. But what is next for you?
So I have a couple of
projects. Besides just basking in the glow of the glory, the fame, the wealth that's coming your way.
Well, if you promise that's what's coming. I think I've got a couple of projects that are on the stove, which I'm trying to heat up as we speak. One of them is a comprehensive crowdsourced database of runaway slave ads, which there are tens of thousands in American newspapers that survive from the slavery era. And some people might be familiar with this and others not. But when an enslaved person ran away, often their owner placed an ad saying, hey, look out for this man or woman. Here's a physical description. Sometimes it'll say how they act, where I think they might be going, what they might be wearing. And in a way, that's as close to a detailed census as or census return or document or whatever as we're going to be able to get on most enslaved people. So there's a lot of information about individuals and how they resisted and how they attempted to shape their own lives in those ads, but there's no comprehensive database of them. So along with a team of other people, several folks here at Cornell and also Josh Rothman at the University of Alabama and Molly Mitchell at the University of New Orleans, we're trying to create a database which we think might end up containing 50,000, 100,000. We're not sure how many individuals. And we're trying to engage the broader public in helping us to process these documents. That's one thing that I've got going on. And I've got a couple other ideas. I mean, certainly there's a book idea that could come from that and a couple of other book ideas that I have. But I'm still putting the ingredients together for those.
All right. Well, Ed Baptist, I want to thank you very much for discussing this book with us today.
Thanks, Dan.
You bet. So Once again, this is Dan Kilbride from New Books in American Studies. We've been talking with Ed Baptist about his book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism, published by Basic Books. And you'll see an icon on the screen. If you click to it, it'll take you right to the Amazon page. And you can contribute to Ed Baptist's retirement fund by buying this terrific book. So this is New Books in American Studies, signing off. So long, everybody.